RadioInfluence.com.
We are back for another edition of the MMA Report Podcast. Of course, I am Jason Floyd. As always, I'm joined by my co-host, Daniel Galvan. Daniel, how the hell you doing, man?
I'm doing great, Jason. I'm doing absolutely great. Just enjoying the week, spending most of my time reading articles, watching videos, and, you know, just chill action. All I can say is finally the 30 for 30 documentary series. They laid an egg. I was not particularly enthused about the baseball documentary they put on, but otherwise, Jason, I'm doing quite well. How about you?
I'm doing not too bad, man. Hopefully all our listeners are out there doing well. Yeah, I watched the 30 for 30 on Sunday on McGuire and Sosa, and yeah, didn't really like that one. I mean, like, how do you tell the McGuire-Sosa story and literally, like, less than 10% of the documentary is about the steroid era?
Yeah, it's literally, like, when I think of documentaries, especially this topic, it's all about answering questions that we had. And they answer none of them. It was like a SportsCenter highlight reel, and it's just insane because it's literally the biggest story in baseball until now. Now the biggest story of baseball is baseball just hates it itself. Baseball is now that emo kid that I was in high school. I just ate lunch and no, I thought no one liked me because apparently baseball doesn't like itself because it doesn't even want to go out there and play baseball. All right, geez. Now I'm angry about baseball, but yeah, it was probably just the wrong time to do a baseball documentary. In addition to it kind of sucking, is that people are just like, don't remind me about baseball. Baseball's being a big jerk right now. There's no reason why I'm not recording this podcast with you right now with the Texas Rangers game on the TV right now. All right. Like, geez, this sport was literally invented for social distancing. And I just had to get that off my chest, Jason.
Yeah, it was crazy as I was watching that documentary. It made me think about a week before we went into, you know, quarantine life of actually being at a spring training game. And, you know, back when life was quote unquote normal, you know, it's been such a long time. And, you know, speaking of documentaries, you know, I had seen a pair of MMA reporters, Sean Morgan and Aaron Bronister, mention about the Fight Lore series that the UFC has on UFC Fight Pass. So decided last weekend to check out the one they had on Kimbo Slice. I thought it was well done by the UFC. It's a Kimbo Slice story told in a UFC narrative, but it's one of those things that you walked away from it. And you know, I tweeted about it, and one of our listeners, Joe, you know, he had responded basically about saying, you know, look at how the WWE has done these documentaries and how good they are. And the WWE's documentaries are absolutely unbelievable. The one that they got right now going on with The Undertaker. I'm not a current, I wouldn't call myself a current fan of the WWE product. You know, when I was younger, watched it a lot. So I really just have the WWE network for these great documentaries that they put on. You know, I remember earlier this year, watched the one on Edge about, you know, him returning, to competition. It was really good. But the one, I guess my one takeaway from the Kimbo, Fight Lore episode was you just can't tell the Kimbo Slice story in 30 minutes.
No, you can't. And I haven't seen the other episodes, but the ones you've described to me, especially the Nick Diaz and Joe Riggs thing, that kind of seems perfect for the Fight Lore formula because it's a small story about Nick Diaz and Joe Riggs fighting each other in the hospital. And it's a 30-minute chunk, whereas Kimbo Slice is a very just amazing character. And there are so many pivots to his story. You could go so deep into the street fighting aspect of his fights. They're so captivating and interesting. Obviously, we're talking about a 1 hour bit on the Elite XC run. We're talking about, you know, a lot of time spent in the UFC and then a lot of time spent in Bellator. And it would take someone who's kind of independent of the UFC and Bellator to put together a great Kimbo Slice documentary, because that's really possible, because it's such a well-rounded story that is in so many different fight promotions. So watching that Fight Lore did get me thinking, like, wow, I have a real appetite for like a 3 hour long Kimbo documentary, a two-part Kimbo documentary. It's just a shame that we weren't able to get that sit-down interview to go with that documentary, because hearing Kimbo's perspective to me is so interesting. But the Fight Lore episode was great. It was so enjoyable. I can't believe I had never seen Jorge Masvidal's street fight. I had not seen that prior to the Fight Lore episode. And to see that was quite interesting. There was a lot of things that I did not know. And I particularly enjoyed the interviews with Kimbo's mother and the manager, and of course his son, which I did not realize that his son was accompanying him to some of these street fights. That's a interesting father-son activity.
I was when I saw, you know, his son, you know, Baby Slice on there, I was shocked just because of him being a Bellator fighter, which they made sure when they talked about him being a current MMA fighter, they made sure not to say that B word. But it was one of those things that, you know, even like when they were talking about the Ultimate Fighter aspect, it's like I would love that if you got everyone who was involved in that season, the fighters and the coaches, and did like a round table of, you know, hey man, what was your perception of Kimbo, you know, before that season? And then, you know, have them talk about being around Kimbo for those weeks of filming, of kind of, you know, then what were their feelings of Kimbo after that was over? I mean, that to me is like, I felt like it was a great 30-minute show, very well done by the UFC. But it left me wanting more. Like, tell me, and just the Ultimate Fighter aspect of me was kind of the thing of like, I would love to hear, you know, even though obviously Brendan Schaub and the UFC don't have the greatest relationship, to hear Brendan Schaub talk about, you know, being around Kimbo. Hear Roy Nelson, you know, who of course beat Kimbo, you know, in the first fight. You know, hear him talk about being around Kimbo. Those are the things that I would love to know more about the Kimbo Slice story, where, I mean, look, I feel like at a minimum, you could do a 2-hour documentary on him.
Yeah, at a minimum. And it's kind of weird because we've seen a push and pull, and what we've been pulled into with the current trend in documentaries is these longer form documentaries. But Kimbo, and really most fighters, can do a pretty dang good one. So I would like a long term one, just because to me, That moment you mentioned is interesting on The Ultimate Fighter. Like, the coolest moment was that initial of him walking into the Tough House. It's something where we constantly are just taking in new content every week, and it's not something that I've ever reflected back on since I've seen it, but it was cool to see all of the fighters, the familiar names we know, like Justin Wren, react to this guy who's this mystical creature is going to actually be living in the same house as them. And that moment was cool. But honestly, I think as far as a professional fighting standpoint, I mean, the most intriguing aspect of the Kimbo Slice story in my mind is the fight against Seth Petruzzelli and what went on with that fight happening. Obviously, that wasn't originally what the plan was. And it was such a devastating loss for Elite XC. When we talk about the rise and fall of Elite XC, that's a huge, huge factor in the fall of that promotion. So that particular touch point, which is not something that was touched on, and it makes sense that it wasn't touched on because we're talking about a 30-minute documentary and that wasn't the primary focus. That is, in fact, the most interesting thing about Kimbo's MMA career, is that fight against Seth Petruzzelli. So you are right. There is just so many things to mine, and Kimbo is such an interesting person because he does give off that, like, scary vibe, and he's a scary man. I mean, they showed the he was in his first fight in Elite XC. I can't remember who he was fighting again. He's going up against a 25 veteran, and he's going up and down the cage looking intimidating, and this veteran's looking scared, and that kind of tells you how scary he was. But this was a guy who had a very unique perspective, a very, like, I'm a protector perspective, or at least that's what they were trying to convey. But yeah, it was an awesome stuff, but you're right in that there's a whole lot more to the Kimbo Slice steak, that a documentarian can dig into. But that was a nice recommendation. I would definitely recommend others check out that fight lore, Jason.
Yeah. I mean, it's an excellent episode. And I remember, so when Bellator announced him versus Ken Shamrock, and it was, either the day before Bellator 134 or the day of Bellator 134. But I remember on fight night when Kimbo walked into the building, you know, the crowd went insane. And whether, you know, whatever your thoughts of Kimbo, what they were as a mixed martial artist, the one thing that you cannot deny is that when you talk about the top draws ever in this sport, if you said who are your top five draws, I don't know how you don't put Kimbo Slice in there.
Yeah, he was a game changer for the Ultimate Fighter, and he was someone who was a major draw, especially on television. That's primarily where a lot of his big professional fights took place, actually, which is a bit interesting, because when you got a guy who's a draw, you want to continue to put him behind that paywall. And there's probably a bit of a missed opportunity there to consistently build him up on pay-per-view. But a huge television draw, big-time factor on The Ultimate Fighter. His fight against Shamrock was interesting, and his fight against Dada 5000 is one of the saddest fights in Bellator history. I guess what's also interesting about this situation is just how much info was actually out there about his heart issues prior to the Dada fight, too. That brings a lot of things into question. But he is someone who was absolutely one of the biggest draws. And a big reason for that was that he was very much like a superhero character. He transcended the sport, and he was like a professional wrestling superstar that happened to be a fighter. And he was the type of guy that it's a shame that people who are just now getting into the sport were not able to experience him, because it was a very unique experience. And honestly, I do not believe we will ever have a guy come up in street fighting make it to MMA. It just doesn't feel possible in the year 2020 that someone can make his name off street fighting. It seems like he would get arrested. He would get canceled. And I think that was a very unique experience in the early part of this century, Jason.
Yeah, it's I mean, obviously you're younger than me, so I just, you know, because I was thinking about this as I was watching the episode, I was like, how did I get introduced to Kimbo Slice? And for me, as, you know, someone who, you know, I graduated high school in 2000, it was this, everyone kind of passed around the link on YouTube to watch his video. Obviously, you being much younger, do you remember when you got introduced to Kimbo Slice?
I don't remember particularly when, but I do remember being aware of him. I do remember of the phone being passed around, and especially people my age, I think, experienced him the same way. It was what you mentioned. But we are just a bunch of kids in school, and, you know, we have a lot of time to ourselves passing things around. So I guarantee you a lot of people born in the mid-1990s first experienced Kimbo Slice in a classroom somewhere with one of their friends showing them one of the fights, or at their friend's house when they would go over and they would watch the fights there. And I wasn't obsessed with Kimbo, but I was aware of Kimbo. And again, I was aware of Kimbo before I became a fan of mixed martial arts. But that shows you where Kimbo is. You know, Kimbo was one of those things that was a major part of internet culture, especially if you were a boy. I think that's something that more gravitates towards a stereotypical boy. Just most boys knew about Kimbo, and obviously plenty of girls did too, but it kind of like, it was just one of those like things like, oh yeah, let's do our own street fights. Like that was our version of fighting taken to like the unreal level. And I think, honest to God, I think if I had to pinpoint what made the Kimbo Slice situation pop, one of the big ones would be the brutal faces of his opponents afterwards, especially that first major fight against D, but just the pure carnage of their faces and how gross it looked after they fought Kimbo. I think that was one of the real draws as a young boy that made me and my friends really intrigued about watching Kimbo Slice's fights on, I feel like it was on World Star Hip Hop, but it could have been somewhere else where we saw him.
It was YouTube for me. I mean, you know, and I remember, man, it was a while ago, someone said, you know, when you think about what YouTube is as a company, they probably owe a lot of gratitude to Kimbo Slice and everyone around Kimbo for putting those videos on YouTube. And I'll never forget him just walking into that building at Bellator 134. You just, you know, you got that, you know, you knew this guy was a huge draw. And look, it wasn't until I pulled up his Wikipedia page that I had forgot that his win over Dada was overturned due to a failed drug test.
Oh, really? Did it say what he tested positive for?
Nandrolone and elevated TE ratio.
Wow. I didn't realize that either. I kind of put that card in the back of my mind. Like, that was a sad card.
But you brought up a great point where after watching that Fight Lord episode, you couldn't help but think about the Dada fight and think about his health condition and wondering, could there have been something done that would not have resulted in him passing away 4 months later?
Yeah, it's a really sad part because you should still be around and You know, I'm sure he'll be inducted. I bet he'll be inducted into the UFC Hall of Fame. Like, I know he only fought twice professionally in the UFC, but I think he deserves to be in the Hall of Fame because he's not, obviously, he's not like a, he just deserves his own wing in the Hall of Fame. I just feel like the reason why is because he was just an absolute enigma and he deserves, his story deserves to be told, but it's a shame that he's still not around. It would have been interesting to see what he would have done. Did he retire before he passed away, Jason? I actually can't remember. Or not.
I don't believe he did. I think that, wow. After a fight, I don't think that there was necessarily a thought, because I think that it kind of seemed at that point that Bellator was kind of trying to transition out of those type of fights that they were doing. I want to say maybe they did. You know, was that the one? I want to say Bellator 149 also had the Hoist and Ken Shamrock fight.
It did.
So I think they were trying to transition their way out of that. But I mean, look, the whole Fight Lore series, I watched the entire series of it, the other episodes last night. My wife actually was watching them with me. She really enjoyed them. You mentioned about the Diaz Riggs show. Nick Diaz staying totally on brand, as they put a little caption up on the screen that Nick Diaz did not show up for the taping of it, and they had to do everything on the phone. The Bruce Buffer one I thought was really good. Talk about his story of how ultimately, how he learns about, his brother, and also how he ends up becoming the announcer for the UFC. And obviously a big part of the show was the fight that him and Frank Trigg had in the elevator, and the Griffin Bonner one I watched, and it kind of made me like want to sit there and say, maybe I need to go back and watch the first season of The Ultimate Fighter.
Yeah. It was an incredible season of The Ultimate Fighter, that first season. I mean, it wasn't just Griffin Bonner. I mean, it was Bobby Southworth and people peeing on each other's, sleeping bags. I think Chris Lieben was the person who peed on somebody. I can't remember so many things that happened, but, dude, it was, was Strange Brew on that season? I can't remember. Was Jason Thacker on that season? It was a crazy, like, you had Diego, Kenny Florian, Koscheck. That was an impeccable season. Maybe we should do like a rewatch of that on the podcast. That might be a good idea, because I think we would enjoy the hell out of it. That was it was just the perfect cast of fighters. Whoever casted that season of The Ultimate Fighter, whoever did the scouting on that season of The Ultimate Fighter, I'm pretty sure it was probably like Joe Silva or something. But whoever did that, I mean, they deserve all the kudos. That was a game changing. Everyone knows how big of a deal The Ultimate Fighter was for the UFC. But yeah, it kind of makes me want to go back and watch it too, now that you mention it, Jason.
Force was telling the story about how he almost didn't go to the taping of the show, that he was literally at the airport and, you know, he ends up getting on the phone with the UFC, and ultimately Dana White gets on the phone and talks him into it, because he was a police officer and he was like less than a month away from, you know, basically if he was, you know, he could get rehired if he walked away for whatever reason. And, he goes on there and look, it was a defining moment, in our sport. And, Jason Thacker was a part of Team Couture, in that episode. And, you know, in them telling the story about how, you know, Dana takes out all the liquor out of the house, and then Stephen Bonner ends up escaping and running, you know, to the liquor store and bringing it back, and nearly gets kicked off the show because of it. I mean, yeah, I really did enjoy it. I mean, it's even with the Griffin Bonner one, and I just felt that there's so much more to that story. And, you know, and I think that right now, because of the lack of live sports that we had, we're all looking for those sports documentaries to watch. It's like we're sitting there going, okay, hey, ESPN, do you somehow never have another 30 for 30 you can run on Sunday night?
Yeah, no, they should just knock them out. And they should just pick the one that no one watched and just pretend like it's a new one. Like, they have all these soccer documentaries that no one saw. They did like a series that was only ESPN soccer. And I guarantee you a lot of people haven't seen them. They should just re-release it and hope no one notices. Or they should release some of the SEC documentaries they just constantly put on the SEC network. Like, those are great. I mean, they're 1 hour long, but yeah, there's a lot of good stuff. I want to see sports, though. Like, I just can't wait. And I don't know. We'll see what happens. I mean, at least the UFC's given us something to dig into. But gosh, I really thought we were going to get some baseball and basketball. But I think we will get basketball eventually. But baseball, oh, that one makes me so sad. But I know for sure we're going to get hockey. They just like literally don't care. And this might be the big year for ice hockey. But yes, Jason, I was literally watching golf this weekend too. I was watching every round. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday on my TV, I had the Charles Schwab Classic on because I am so hungry for live sports. So that shows you how damn sad I am. And I've watched all the boxing cards that have been on ESPN too. I've consumed everything.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what we're all kind of doing. We're all hoping sports is going to come back. But, you know, the UFC is always here. I mean, you know, we talked last week on the podcast, you know, last Saturday's Fight Night card was not a sexy card on paper. But, Daniel, you know what? It delivered, you know, right from the start. We have three fights to kick off the card, all finish in under a minute. Christian Aguilar, Tyson Am, and Julia Avila all looking great. Mirab Davishvili goes out there and does what he does, breaking his own takedown record, gets 13 takedowns in that fight. Jordan Espinosa, that was a great performance he had. And of course, obviously the main event, Cynthia Calvillo, she's now elevated herself into a contender at 125 pounds. You know, Jessica Eye misses weight. I thought one of the most, the interesting thing that Cynthia Calvillo said after the fact, that even though Jessica Eye only weighed in 0.25 pounds over the flyweight limit, she's like, yeah, we got a text message that said that she was going to be at least 3 pounds over, and she used the old Daniel Cormier trick. You know, because that's in that fight, Daniel, Cynthia Calvillo, and she talked about it, she did not have a good opening round. And I remember after watching that opening round, you're like, okay. And then all of a sudden, man, Cynthia Calvillo just completely turns it around. And I want to say it was probably in the third round. I'm just sitting there going, okay, I don't see how Jessica Eye is going to come back in this fight.
No, this was a hell of a performance from Calvillo. And I think for her, a big part of that, as she mentioned, I think in some of her post-fight comments, was that first round was kind of just sticking her hand in her mouth and sticking in the air and seeing which direction the wind was going to blow, because this was a unique experience for her being a 5-round fight. It was kind of getting her feet in the water, and boom, she uses her wrestling to go along with some of her stand-up, and it was a really, really convincing win for Calvillo. I mean, she was changing weight classes, and again, that's kind of where I'm going to push back on her criticism of Jessica Eye, is that it's hard to criticize someone for missing weight if you've done it recently. But she moves up in the weight class, looks great, is clearly the title challenger for Shevchenko, because this is a division that has very few. Wouldn't be surprised if she still takes on someone else. That could certainly happen, maybe Chikagian, but honestly, it's probably just going to be Calvillo and Shevchenko next. But she certainly looked good, and we kind of knew what she was going to bring to the table in terms of, like, it was going to be her wrestling that was going to probably pave the way to go along with her stand-up. That would kind of work in congruence, and Jessica is kind of tough to take down, but she was able to do it 4 times throughout that fight, I believe. And it was just Cynthia, who started her UFC run as a really big-time potential fighter, struggled a little bit, and she just returned to form, potentially earning a title shot. And on the flip side, I mean, Jessica Eye could not have had a worse week. I mean, she looked so awful on the weigh-in scale. You sent me a picture of her having to use the scale almost like she was. She needed it to stand up almost, and she looked awful. She missed weight. She's missed weight lots of times. She's a fighter who's very marketable for the UFC. She really is. She's just someone who gets headlines. She knows how to get headlines, and she's someone the UFC should really focus on, but she definitely needs to focus on herself, because that was a tough loss for Jessica Eye. Wouldn't be surprised if she's able to rehabilitate her career and get another title shot, but it's a very long road back for Jessica Eye. Overall, it was just a rough week for her, as she missed weight and also had a pretty bad performance.
And now Jessica Eye, 5-7-1 no contest in the UFC, back-to-back fights where she has missed weight now. And I mean, that the image and watching that video of her standing on the scale where that's an instance where I wish a commissioner or, the head of the commission would come out and explain why after that image and her talking about how she can barely stand of why she was allowed to compete. I think that's the one thing that you wonder with her. And it was a performance that you just sat there. And as I mentioned, after the first round, you just really didn't see, there was a path to her getting the win. You look at 125 pounds now as this division shakes out, the UFC is already, their plan is to, have JoJo Calderwood challenge Valentina Shevchenko initially. I want to say that was supposed to happen June 6th when they were going to go to, I want to say it was Australia, before we got into the pandemic. I want to say it was either Australia or New Zealand that card was going to happen in. So that's there. Cynthia Calvillo, Caitlin Chookagian, to me, is the fight to make. Chookagian, tweeted basically after the fact saying, let's go. And Cynthia Calvillo after, it's like, hey, yeah, I'm good with it. Of course, her now at American Kickboxing Academy, great win for her. Andre Feely, Charles Jourdain was a very fun fight to watch. It's one of those fights that if you're in that Team Alpha Male corner, you're probably sitting there going, Andre, man, why are you not going for more takedowns? Because he was only getting the takedowns right at the end, and he was controlling Jourdain on the ground.
Yeah, and Jourdain was really dang good on the feet, too. That was a great fight. I think Andre likes to be an entertaining fighter for sure. That may be a big reason why he's kind of flip-flopped a lot, but he really showcased his talent. And this could be a nice little start for him to finally put together a run in the UFC. Overall, Andre looked good, and that was probably the most enjoyable fight of the whole fight card. But it was a fight card that obviously didn't have a lot of like star power, but there were a lot of fighters having performances, Jason, like Andre Feely, that one day they could potentially be a star. I mean, you mentioned that initial three fights. That was unbelievable to get three consecutive fights start the card that ended in under a minute. I mean, I signed me up for the small cage. I mean, the one performance that stuck out the most to me, I mean, as impressive as it was for a man like Christian Aguilera to get a victory, and that guy has so much pent-up frustration, I'm sure he was bullied, called Christine Aguilera his whole life. That was great. But for the love of goodness gracious, what is the Raging Panda, something like that, Julie Avila? Dude, star power. I mean, because of the name Panda, Raging Panda, something like that, and the way she fights and the way she finishes fights and ends them early, if she's able to piece together wins like that, which don't look technically great, but it looks like you're just spamming the AB button on Street Fighter, if she's able to win that a couple times, don't look now. Amanda Nunes might have a challenger. Now, this is very early. I mean, we're talking about a win over Gina Mazzani, but it's not a long road to a championship opportunity. And if Avila does perform exactly like this in her next few fights, that's the perfect type of fighter that you can actually build some hype around and promote. And Julia was not the only fighter that you looked at watching this card on Saturday and you thought down the line, this is going to be a fighter who's going to make some waves in his or her particular division. So that's kind of what this card meant to me. It was a pretty bad card in terms of star power, but it was still interesting because, again, like, I'm a degenerate for mixed martial arts.
Sign me up for a small cage because, it's always been the thought process with the smaller cage has been how it benefits grapplers. But when you look at, these, we've now had, three cards at the Apex now where, it to me, it's just brought so much. It's forced engagement. It's forced action. And I think that the fans have been the biggest winner of this. I mean, yes, it was not a sexy card on paper, but these fights absolutely delivered. And it was a fun card to watch. We'll mention, I talked to Christian Aguilera earlier today. So check that out on the MMAreport.com. Talk to him about his win there. But, while Daniel White, last week's card was not a sexy card, when you look at this Saturday's UFC fight night card, which is going to be headlined by Curtis Blaydes versus Alexander Volkov, on paper, man, this is a fight card I'm looking forward to watching on Saturday night.
Yeah, it is. I mean, to me, the thing that's going to get my big old butt in the seat here, and it's the type of card that I'm probably going to invite my friends over to watch because I cannot wait to see Josh Emmett take on Shane Burgos. I mean, that's the great fight, dude. Like, oh God, that's a hell of a co-main event. And overall, I mean, this card is quite interesting, but that fight in particular, Burgos and Emmett, I mean, that's the thing that's driving me personally into the television set.
Yeah, no, you're spot on. I love that matchup. You know, I was looking a little bit at Alexander Volkov today, and kind of the interesting thing is that he's a guy that I think in various fights in the UFC, maybe we've counted him out, but he hasn't fought a wrestler. When you think about, you know, the two people that you consider grapplers that he's fought would be Fabricio Werdum and Roy Nelson. But so obviously this is, you know, Curtis Blaydes. We know what he can do with his abilities. He's the biggest betting favorite on the card, and rightfully so. I think he should be the big betting favorite. So, you know, really interesting to see, can Volkov keep this fight on the feet? Can he force Curtis Blaydes to beat him in a standing fight? I don't think that's the case. I think you'll see, you know, Curtis get to the ground. But yeah, I like that Burgos versus Josh Emmett fight. You know, Roosevelt Roberts, quick turnaround for him, taking on Jim Miller. I think Lyman Good versus Blood Muhammad has a chance to be a really interesting fight. Camacho Frivola is another one that does interest me as well. You know, you got Roxanne Modafferi, you know, taking on Lauren Murphy. I mean, huge fight there for Roxanne. Courtney Casey, Jillian Robinson's another fight that I like. You know, Austin Hubbard, he's got a new opponent, Max, and I'm not even going to try to butcher his last name, but a 5-0 prospect who's replacing Joe Selecki, who I actually talked to Joe. It was sometimes late last week, like last Thursday, last Thursday. You know, he announced on his Instagram that due to unforeseen reasons, you know, out of his control, that he was going to have to pull out of the fight. So Max, you know, having his 5-0, very interesting. But overall, I'm looking forward to watching it. But to me, the reason you're tuning in ultimately is that main event, co-main event.
Yeah, you're right to highlight the main event as well. I mean, it's kind of like the Curtis Blaydes coming out party, because he's just climbing up the ranks in the heavyweight division, and obviously he's hoping that Francis Ngannou doesn't end up with that heavyweight title, because obviously it's going to be Ngannou versus the winner of Stipe and Cormier, and a Blaydes-Ngannou fight would probably be something where we remember the last one, but it's something that's probably going to be inevitable, because Curtis just has unreal talent. Especially coming off his most recent victory, it's hard to imagine him losing to someone not named Stipe or Ngannou. And I think that's going to continue against Alexander Volkov. The biggest question for this fight is how entertaining it is and whether or not it's a highlight reel performance. There's a great chance it's a boring contest, and that's probably the most likely outcome. But for Curtis Blaydes to continue to build his stock, especially on ESPN, it's going to have to be through making this something memorable. And, that is the big question for the main event, is whether or not Curtis is going to be able to elevate himself, because it's not only a competition against Volkov, it's a competition to try and figure out how to make himself a bigger star. And again, the co-main event is just a great contest between top featherweights who have shown a propensity for excitement. So those two fights are it for me. Any opportunity to see Clay Guida fight, I enjoy. He's just been a stalwart of exciting fights. Occasionally he has had his duds. But Guida versus Green is interesting just to watch him fight. You mentioned Camacho Frivola. That's probably going to be the second most likely fight to win fight of the night behind Emmett and Burgos. I mean, both those guys just go out there and bang, bro. I believe, I don't know how to say that guy's name, Max Roscoff. But we're going to have to figure it out, probably. I know he's late replacement against Austin Hubbard, but I was looking up his resume. Undefeated, obviously not a whole lot of fights under his belt, but a great resume as a wrestler at NC State, and I wouldn't be surprised if he actually wins this lightweight contest, and we will have to be forced to learn his last name. But I'm looking forward to that lightweight contest, and as you mentioned it, Roxanne Modafferi, Lauren Murphy is actually one of the more intriguing fights on this card for me, just because Modafferi has had such an unbelievable resurgence late in her career. She has a lethal top game. If she's able to get on top of you, that's going to put you in a very, very tough position. So I'm certainly thinking that Modafferi Lauren Murphy fight is actually one of the more intriguing contests in my mind, even though it's kind of buried down on the card.
Yeah, you know, when you look at the heavyweight division, we're going to have a little bit of a spotlight here with this fight. And then in August, as it was announced today, that Derek Lewis and Alexio Linick is going to headline the August 8th card in Vegas. And then, of course, August 15th, we've got Cormier and Miocic. Cormier, you know, he's making it pretty well known that, you know, win or lose, this will be the last fight for him. Whether or not we truly believe that is maybe something that we'll have to figure out after August the 15th. But, you know, to kind of see how this heavyweight division does kind of unfold. So, you know, I'm looking forward to Saturday's UFC Fight Night card. Of course, should note a little 1 hour start time earlier this week as opposed to the past couple UFC events. So the main card is going to start at 8 p.m. Eastern time as opposed to 9 p.m. Eastern time. And your prelims will also be 1 hour earlier. They'll start at 5 p.m. Eastern time. Of course, you know, we've had, you know, these cards, it seems like there's a change every week. So that's as we currently record this show, that is the scheduled start times on Saturday. And, yeah, man, I will tell you, man, I was a little tired last Saturday. So, the hour start time earlier, I'm all for it, Daniel. I like these earlier fight cards. So yeah, but looking forward to it. But, you know, over the past couple of weeks, Daniel, we've been, you know, counting down the top 100 active MMA fighters, and we've finally got to the top 10 here this week, Daniel. And, you know, and of course you've talked about this, this is a list you made kind of right as we started quarantine life. So there's definitely going to be some changes in this list. So, give a little asterisk on when this list was created, but, you know, let's start with number 10, a guy that, you know, a lot of people are kind of wondering what the ceiling is for him. He's a current UFC middleweight champion, and that's Israel Adesanya. You know, also, you know, all signs point to him versus Paulo Costa. I was listening to Dana White on the Schmoes podcast, kind of alluding to the potential of could, you know, Israel and Costa be coaches for the next season of The Ultimate Fighter, which I'm still amazed that Dana still does not want to just give up on The Ultimate Fighter. But, you know, Israel is a guy that he could, a year from now, maybe he's top five in this list.
Well, as we're talking, he's moved up to number 8. I'll tell you that much. There are two names on this list that are probably would no longer be on there, but he certainly is a deserving champion here. Israel had a bad fight in his last fight against Yoel Romero, and that was kind of stunting his growth, because the fight against Romero was something that really could have been a big time performance for him to continue to validate kind of the legacy he's built in. But he's still on the right track. I mean, he still has the strap around his waist. And for Adesanya, he has an unbelievable star presence, a great potential to be a big time money draw. He isn't there yet, but it's going to be predicated on his ability to have dominant victories or big time fights. So I really like Israel a whole lot, especially outside of the cage, man. He has a real poise and leadership about him, and I feel like Israel is the type of fighter that the UFC should be fortunate that they have. But for him, it's all about continuing to validate himself, because he's kind of separated himself and all the in that. There's a real thought here that whenever he does lose this championship, whoever the opponent is, if he's able to get past Paulo Costa, by the way, it will be a shock. It wouldn't be that big of a shock if Costa beat him, because Costa is literally the Terminator. But after that, it wouldn't be surprising if Adesanya holds onto that strap for a long time. So Adesanya Costa, that's probably the type of fight that could really vault Adesanya into super duper star status. He isn't quite there yet, but he's still a superstar in the UFC.
Number 9 is also a UFC champion, and that's Valentina Shevchenko. You know, obviously everyone knows how great she is, and she's absolutely, you know, dominated this 125-pound division. There's not really a lot of fights there's not really a fight at 125 that really gets me interested about her, with the exception of her going back up to 35 to take on Amanda Nunes.
Yeah, I mean, the most interesting fight at 125 for her, ooh, is probably going to be Aleem Malay McFarland. I mean, that'd be the most interesting fight. It would be a fight where Aleem Malay would be a pretty big underdog, unfortunately for Aleem Malay, but that would probably be the most intriguing fight, but that obviously won't happen as she's under contract. Yeah, Shevchenko, so dominant, would probably have been higher on this list when I first made it if she didn't have those clear losses to Amanda Nunes. But she's putting herself in a position to be known as the second greatest female fighter of all time. So that's not too bad for Shevchenko.
Yeah, Lima just she signed a new deal with Bellator. I want to say beginning of this year, so she's going anywhere. But yeah, Valentina just, you know, I mean, that's the thing is, like, if you look at the current women's 125 pound division, who's going to be the fighter that's going to be the less of an underdog, I guess would be the way to say it. I mean, I mean, obviously Cynthia had a great fight, but I would imagine she'd still probably be a 5 or 6 to 1 underdog.
Yeah, to me, the name to look at, and this is a long ways away, but Amanda Ribas is someone who at least has upside. It'll be interesting to see what she does. So she would be one of those fighters who has upside. And then the other one would be Yan Xinan, would be the other flyweight I would look at in terms of these two at least have upside. But there's such a major gap that even, you know, as you mentioned, Cavillo would be a pretty big dog against Shevchenko.
Well, and I think that, you know,
I'm sorry, I was looking at the strawweight rankings. I was looking at the strawweight rankings. I screwed that up. No, never mind. There's no one there. I just looked at the flyweight rankings. I was wrong. Literally no one. So, yeah, my thought process here is Ribas should put on 10 pounds and take on Shevchenko, Jason.
Well, it's, you know, Dana has not been... He's not all on board for doing the trilogy fight with Amanda and Valentina just because Amanda's already beat her twice. But, you know, he's mentioned about, you know, Weili Zhang coming up to 125 pounds. But, you know, obviously, you know, she has got still work to do at 115 pounds. So we'll see what happens there. Number 8, another UFC champion. I think you're getting kind of a theme here. Number 8, Alexander Volkanovski, of course, going to defend his title in the co-main event of UFC 251. And he has a rematch against the former champion, Max Holloway.
Yeah. Let me make sure I got the right rankings here. All right, featherweight division. Let's look at who we got here, Volkanovski. Yeah, Volkanovski Holloway, you know, we talked about it. Not super enthused about that contest, but we'll watch it anyway because it was, a huge win. If you were a Volkanovski fan before that Holloway fight, dude, you were so validated by that performance. It was a major jump up from where people may have considered him. He was a clear-cut challenger for Holloway, but it was just a well-done win. And for Volkanovski, I mean, the most interesting part of his story to me is the fact that he was a professional athlete as a rugby player. He made that transition to MMA, and to be able to make that transition and to get to this level after already playing a radically different professional sport speaks to how this sport probably just comes naturally to Volkanovski. But he asserted himself as a guy who could potentially hold on to the championship for a very long time, but he's going to have to do it once again, prove it once again against one of the more successful featherweight champions in the rematch against Holloway.
You know, obviously this fight would never happen because of, you know, one guy's in the UFC, one guy's in Bellator. But if Volkanovski versus Patricio Pitbull was booked, would you give Patricio a pretty good shot?
Yeah, I would, man. I mean, Patricio would be the dog in my mind, but Patricio has done nothing except for have success in the past few years. I mean, he's done so well, and some of his more recent performances has been just him taking it another level. So Patricio would certainly be the underdog here. But if you told me I could only watch one fight for Volkanovski, it would be against Pitbull, would be the one I would choose. Realistically, I mean, this Zabit fight is obviously possible. Calvin Kattar got announced for a pretty big fight against Dan Ige, and I think one of those guys could certainly vault themselves up with the win there in a main event slot in Fight Island. But Volkanovski Pitbull is certainly the most intriguing featherweight contest that unfortunately won't happen.
Yeah, one of the things that I saw this morning when I woke up and I saw the news of Calvin Kattar versus Dan Ige, I saw Tyson, his coach and manager, puts on Facebook, scared money, don't make money. Because my first thought was like, in terms of a rankings aspect, obviously I think it's not the fight that probably Calvin wanted. I think he would have hoped to get somebody there, you know, potentially in the top five. But yeah, that's going to be a good fight. I mean, I saw that they moved the Frankie Yeager-Pedro Munhoz fight that was supposed to be on 251. They moved that to the July 15th card, which will be headlined by Cater and Ige. That's going to be the co-main event of that fight card. Yeah, UFC 251, that's a great lineup. And speaking of 251, I mean, the welterweight champion Kamaru Usman is going to headline the event, and he is number 7. And I think potentially Kamaru Usman could be, you know, top 4, you know, 1 year from now.
Yeah, I mean, he's already moving up 2 spots already. So he's already at number 5 in my mind. But the talent is there. What he's shown in his fight against Woodley, his fight against Dos Anjos, his fight against Covington, it's like this dude is a well-oiled machine. I think for me, my biggest concern for Kamaru Usman is the ability to recover from championship fights and fight camps. I think the injury bug is going to be something he continues to deal with, and he really went into in detail with that with Joe Rogan. So for Kamaru, it's all about recovery and making sure that his body is performing up to where his talent level is. He's just a well-rounded machine, man. He's great at everything. Obviously, he's known for his base as a wrestler, but his volume, his power, stand-up is quite good as well. The fight against Gilbert Burns is going to be very interesting because Gilbert Burns is just on another level currently. I don't know what he did, but he has unreal momentum. And even though it's not the fight that I think we all want to see, you know, the fight we probably all want to see is Usman and Masvidal. The fight that maybe makes the most sense is Edwards, but Burns certainly deserves a title shot given his resume, and potentially he could pull off that win just because he probably drank some egg from an eagle and is just performing at a crazy level. He has all the momentum, but Usman thus far has showcased like high level skills in every facet of the game, even going down to strength and conditioning.
Yeah, I mean, you look at this run that Gilbert Burns has been on this year, just an unbelievable run that he's had. And to me, I think when you're looking at Kamaru Usman, maybe a year from now, maybe the conversation is you know, how far away could he be from, you know, potentially challenging George St. Pierre as the greatest welterweight champion of all time. Now, of these top 10 fighters, there's only one fighter who is not a current UFC fighter on this list. Not hard to figure that out, and that's Demetrius Johnson, who I feel like look, the guy's getting paid in one championship, Daniel, but he's kind of become a little bit of a forgotten guy here in the States.
Yeah, I think he's got to come back to the UFC. I mean, he has to. He's one of the best fighters of all time, and it's just a shame that he's fighting in ONE FC just because the opponent level isn't there. But he's been successful. Obviously, his last performance was a loss, and that's why he's at number 6 and not, I don't know, number 1. I mean, if we did this in 2017, there's probably him being at number 1 is possible because he was just doing unbelievable things in the flyweight division. He was it was just unbelievable to see him perform. It was truly, truly, truly something special where he was like a video game character inside the cage. And the defining trait of Demetrius to me, other than just being such a smart fighter, was how fast he moved, how fast he transitioned, and how fast it seemed like his brain works. So he really had a lot of success, man, because it takes an incredible run to weigh 125 pounds and to be considered the pound-for-pound best fighter in the world. But there was a time when that happened, and since then he's only dropped one fight, and that was a split decision to Henry Cejudo, and after that he's reeled off 3 wins in a row.
And I don't think we'll ever see DJ back in the UFC just because of the amount of money he's making in ONE championships. But, man, it, you know, if for some reason he came back to the UFC tomorrow, it makes you wonder, could that be a fight that would drag, you know, Henry Cejudo back, even though...
Well, you know, here's the thing. Here's the thing. He might be making a lot of money from ONE FC now. Will ONE FC be around in 3 years? I don't know, man. I mean, I know they talk about making video games and being like the number 2 promotion in the world or something like that. But I don't know if ONE FC's around in 2 years, Jason.
A lot of those ONE FC press releases, I just don't take serious at all. I just don't. You know, because ultimately is, you know, here in the United States, you know, yes, they could be very popular in Asia. But here in the United States, you know, how many casual fans have any clue what ONE Championship is?
0. I mean, maybe 1. Or 2.
That's their problem, they have to figure out a way that they can somehow get people to understand who they are in the United States. And unfortunately, if you're talking about your cards are on at 8 o'clock, you know, in the morning, East Coast time on a Friday morning, I just think it's going to be very difficult for them to succeed. I mean, look, I think that it's great what Fighters are able to make over there, but the reality is I think how they view themselves and I think reality here in the United States are two different things. Now, number five is a guy that obviously prior to his last loss was considered, you know, the second best lightweight in the world, and that's Tony Ferguson.
Yeah, he would obviously be one of the guys who would no longer be a part of the top 10. But, you know, his resume prior to that would have kept him afloat, you know, within the top 25 for sure. Was kind of like an uncrowned, undisputed champion if Nurmagomedov did not exist at lightweight, really. But obviously Khabib does exist, and they've been doing a tug of war for who's the best 155er on the planet. But Gaethje knocked him down. And prior to that, I mean, it was just an incredible run that Tony Ferguson went on, and for him, he is up there in age, and it's just a matter of whether or not he's able to return to form. If anyone's able to, I think it's someone like Ferguson, who has just a quite an intriguing outlook on life and approach to all kinds of things, including rehabilitation.
Yeah, it's just, I think it's probably unfortunate as fight fans that we're never going to get that fight with him. It could be most likely. Number four is a guy we mentioned, and obviously, you know, potentially not on this list come 1 year from now, and that's Henry Cejudo.
Yeah, I would almost take him off now because he retired. But he's probably going to return anyway because he's literally talking about fighting Volkanovski after like 2 weeks of being retired. So, like, he's coming back. But I would take him off just because he quote-unquote retired. I guess the question is he still getting tested? Drug tested is my big question. Yeah. Look, man. Look at this list that we got here. We have a top 10, 9 fighters in the UFC, and two of them, one's retired, and the other one we're going to get to in a bit, is having a big-time fight with him. You go down the list, you got Connor, 11 to 20, having issues with the UFC. Jorge, up there, having issues with the UFC. And the fighter after Cejudo is hinting at retirement, too, man. All these premier fighters are retiring. I mean, what's next? Is Valentina Shevchenko going to tell us she's going to retire, too, Jason?
Look, you know you never believe retirements in combat sports.
Yeah, you never believe two things in combat sports: retirements and payouts.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, yeah, you just can't do it. You know, number three, Amanda Nunes, who you mentioned about retirement, she had mentioned recently in an interview, she said, quote, "I've achieved everything I wanted. I'm well. I can go on with my life, maybe take a new step, maybe find new talents, help some girls there, maybe a coach too." Now, Dana White was informed of this this statement from her when he appeared on the Schmozone podcast, where this is what Dana White said. He goes, quote, "I will kill her." You know, he did. Now, he said this while smiling when hearing about this comment from Amanda Nunes. He goes on to say, "I literally just told Sean and Mick in the last meeting, let's get this featherweight division built for her. Let's build this division for her and let's start figuring this out. Now she's talking about retiring. You know what's awesome about that when you think about it? Her retiring isn't awesome. That actually drives me nuts. You know how I always say if you're talking about retirement, you probably should, unless you're where she's at. It's like what I said about Cormier when he was talking about retirement a couple of years ago."
Dude, poor Dana White. Feel bad for the man. He's got every top fighter wanting to retire. And Amanda, can you blame her? She's got no competition. I mean, what is there? She's already the best female fighter of all time. The one thing that is there is money, 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 money. She's going to be able to make money, 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 being the best in the world of fighting fighters and whatnot. But there obviously isn't a challenger there. I mean, maybe the possibility for the biggest money fight for Amanda would be to take a year off, would be to step down, let someone else claim the championship, get the promotion behind her. Amanda comes back, then we have the big money fight. But there's a vacuum of stars in the UFC. A lot of them are leaving the dance table, Cejudo included. And even if it's Amanda Nunes versus a mop, that will still be more intriguing than a lot of the, you know, things they can put together, because we are talking about the GOAT. And there are possible challengers. Featherweight division is quite barren. You would have wished the UFC would have figured, hey, maybe we should build this around Amanda Nunes a year ago. But there are some fighters on the peripheral. I mentioned Julia Avila. Fighters like that who maybe down the line will be real intriguing contenders. But the next big money fight is probably the fight against Shevchenko, the rematch.
I hope Amanda continues to fight just because, like, I like watching greatness, but I can't blame her. It's just funny how it's, like, become the trendy thing to do if you're a top fighter is to retire. I mean, you imagine just a wave, like, you know, Kevin Durant's like, oh, I'm going to retire, and LeBron's like, I'm going to retire, and Steph Curry's like, I'm going to retire. Like, y'all are still in your prime, but that's the trend here in the UFC.
I think also you have to look at what's going on in her life with, you know, her and her wife Nina Ansaroff. Or she's gonna I believe Nina's set to have their baby in September. So I mean, I'm sure that's probably part of it. And you know, and if you're a man, Nunez, I mean, obviously if you've made enough money where you feel that you're set for life type thing, maybe, you know, or maybe just going to take, you know, someone to get her excited, to compete. Number two on our top 100 list is, the UFC. Well, I guess he's a light heavyweight champion, John Jones.
Yeah, I guess so too. He's obviously fighting with the UFC, but nah, wouldn't be surprised if we have an announcement of a potential fight eventually. You know, these top three, Nunez, Jones, I think we all know who number one is. I mean, these are all clearly in their own category. The reason, I mean, Jones really should be number one, but a big reason why he's not is his performances against Reyes. His performance against Santos were not great. They weren't dominant. And you can make an argument that he lost those decision to Reyes. And you can, you know, be like, dang, if Santos didn't tear every ligament in his leg, he probably would have won that fight. So those two performances is why John Jones, who has one of the most impressive resumes in the history of the sport on paper, is number two and not number one.
And of course, obviously, number one is the lightweight champion, Khabib Nurmagomedov, slated to have a I can't think of the word.
Championship fight?
A defense?
Yeah, we've got interim champion and regular champion. Yeah.
Unification.
Unification. Yeah. Unification about. That's the word I'm looking for.
It's all right.
For.
It's all right. I was looking up strawweights to look at her flyweight title. So I've already won the dumb moment of the podcast.
But, I mean, obviously, Khabib and that Gaethje fight is going to be a really interesting fight, you know, because obviously the defensive wrestling that Justin Gaethje has. And, you know, I think really the question is, you know, if you said yes or no, Khabib Nurmagomedov is undefeated 1 year from now, I don't know how many people would say no, he's not.
Oh, gosh, I don't know. That's a tough question. And the only reason why it's tough is because he's going to face some tough dudes. He's going to face Gaethje. That's a tough dude. And his saving grace to remain undefeated, I mean, other than the fact that he's like the best lightweight ever, probably, is that he's probably going to be fighting Conor. But you look at Nurmagomedov, and it's just like, this guy is unbelievable. If he's able to continue to fight, he's going to assert himself as a guy who is literally the GOAT. Think about this. He's 28-0. 28-0. Imagine this dude like gets to like 35-0 one day. I mean, in the history of this sport, I do not believe we've ever seen someone be undefeated as a champion for years. And obviously, we're just getting started with the Khabib run. He's had two defenses of the lightweight championship. But it's very exciting for Nurmagomedov because he's one of the first times in a long time we've had someone who does not have a blemish on his record. Even John Jones had the blemish of Matt Hamill's blood on his elbow. That was that blemish. But Nurmagomedov, unbelievable. He has a lot of, I mean, Gaethje's going to be a tough challenge, and Conor will be tough, but that's a real winnable fight for him, as we saw the last time they fought. And I guess the other guy to look at would be, if Tony Ferguson is actually able to rebound, and after that, then his biggest concern is probably, well, let's say maybe Dan Hooker will get a big win over Poirier. That's possible. But other than that, then it's like, all right, Khabib, now it's time to do some super fights.
Yeah, I mean, to me, if Khabib's going to lose the lightweight title, I think it's in September against Gaethje.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, you never know in the sport, but and it's obvious that the interim champion is probably the most realistically exciting challenger. But Gaethje, dude, he leveled up like three levels in the Ferguson fight. I mean, think about the performance he put against Tony Ferguson. That Ferguson Nurmagomedov fight was going to be probably even odds, or Nurmagomedov was going to be a slight favorite. Gaethje obliterated Ferguson.
So you're right in that his best challenger might in fact be his next fight.
Yeah, we'll see what happens there. But, you know, you mentioned about, you know, fighters who are having their issues with the UFC. And, you know, Jorge Masvidal, is it, you know, the UFC actually kind of cave in on him, but the damage was done. So he doesn't get the fight. You know, they turned to Leon Edwards' inability to train. So he was unable to take the fight against Kamaru Usman. I think, question mark for me is, do we see Jorge Masvidal inside the UFC octagon in 2020?
I hope so. I really do, man. He was the biggest. He was the MVP of the UFC last year, and to not see him fight would be a damn shame. And it's unfortunate because the Usman fight that's what made the most sense. That's like when you're putting the puzzle together, that just fits like a glove. But I don't know. And I guess we're looking at, if he does fight, who is it? I think the clear answer is Conor McGregor. But Dana White's him to sit out until the Khabib Gaethje fight takes place. So I can't look and think of another fight that kind of would give Masvidal, I guess other than the Diaz rematch, the type of money that he's looking for.
I mean, I think there's heat to make the Colby Covington fight.
Good point. I missed that one. You're right.
But does it bring him, you know, the kind of money that the UFC paid him to fight Nate Diaz? I don't know.
That's a great point. That's a fight to make, actually. I did not think about that. I don't know why I glossed over that fight. But those two are going to have the greatest trash talk of all time. It sucks because I feel like a pre-fight brawl is messed up in the social distancing age, right? Like, everyone's going to be touching each other. So I don't know if you can do that, but those two are likely to brawl if you put them in the same... Dude, that's the fight to make, for sure. And the UFC should just give them some money. I mean, they can afford it. They're paying guys 18%. So I'm pretty sure they have enough money in the vault to give Masvidal the cash.
Now, the other interesting thing that we've seen over the past couple of days, it is not good to be Joe Silva, who lives up in Virginia right now, because everyone's just coming after him.
Yeah, on Twitter, we saw so many fighters talk about Joe Silva and how, I guess, he was kind of like an ass. Just kind of an ass. Saying mean things to guys before and after fights, kind of bringing them down. And I think a big reason why is that he was a company man. He was trying to negotiate them down. And, you know, he was probably a great employee for the UFC, but he did it in a way, according to these fighters, that was not great. You look at the story Eddie Alvarez put out there, and Gray Maynard, I believe, talked about it. Several fighters did. And that was interesting because when I thought of Joe Silva, I never thought of that aspect of his character. I always thought of him as this savant that was real quiet, didn't like getting on planes, and was kind of a genius, and he was that. But it also appears that he's also kind of an ass to fighters, which is crazy because there's no need for it. There really wasn't. I know he's probably trying to bring their prices down and manipulate them and whatnot, but it seemed like his behavior was something that should be kind of looked down upon, and that's unfortunate because that's a real blemish on his legacy. Yeah, that's kind of my thoughts on that issue.
There was always stories I would hear about Joe Silva. I remember a fighter telling me, who was fighting at 205 pounds, that Joe Silva told him, says, "Oh, you're an 85er. And he's just like, "I can't make 85. You know, and like, you hear those stories, and, you know, and look, and it's not like Joe's going to do interviews. So it's not like he's going to try to defend himself here. But, you know, we're in a very interesting time right now where fighters are, you know, using their social media accounts. And I feel like, I think ultimately, really, it was Gray Maynard and him. And I know now he's doing interviews, but, you know, really just on social media of talking about, you know, talking about his pay and, you know, some of the things that you heard that he mentioned about, you know, his fights with Frankie Edgar and how much he got paid and all that. And it's just crazy. You know, it's crazy to hear these things. You know, this, as I said, the Silva stories aren't really shocking to me. But I feel like this is just like, you know, 'cause in the past, fighters were really not keen on giving their true opinions about people. And I don't know, you know, if it's just the fact that other fighters are now doing it, but for a long time, fighters would say stuff to you privately, but now it's going public, and it made Twitter's a very interesting place right now.
Every day it's intriguing, man. Different cast of characters, and everyone's airing out their dirty laundry, and I'm here for it, man. Give me a box of popcorn. I'll wake up in the morning and see what I missed overnight, because it is quite interesting. Some of these stories are great, and you know, it's unfortunate what transpired, but it's also a nice little microscope on the cruel reality of some of these things. And it'll be interesting to see who gets the treatment next. Was Bruce Buffer, was he tripping guys backstage? You know, was John McCarthy, you know, pooping in guys' bags? I mean, probably not. Those two guys are awesome, but you never know who's next. You know, who's the next guy that's going to get canceled. But yeah, Joe was the most recent one.
Speaking of who's next, who should Anderson Silva fight?
Oh yeah, that's been a big talking point, right? Anthony Pettis called for the fight. Conor McGregor called for the fight. Dana called them both nuts, and he's looking forward. He's got two fights left on the contract. Jason, look, this man is 45 years old. You know, he should be treated with care. And I, honest to goodness, don't know. It's hard. But this is the formula I would go with, Jason. Obviously, number one, if you can do it, you put him in the cage against George St. Pierre. That would be number one for me, just because that would be the biggest, that would be the most significant pay-per-view draw for Silva in my mind. But I think for me, the formula I would do with Anderson Silva is pretty simple. It would be, I want to put him in the biggest possible fight in terms of, like, let's give him a guy who's also very much past his prime, has some name value, and potentially Anderson's going to be able to go out there and beat him. And after that, we can feed him to a younger guy. And at that point, it's like, all right, who can we feed him to? And I think you're looking at someone like, I don't know, Marvin Vettori, something like that would be the second fight I would go to for Anderson Silva. But as far as the first fight, Jason, I think the one fight I ended up kind of getting back towards was the was like a potential fight against Chris Weidman would be the big quote unquote money fight I would do for Anderson.
Weidman is the first name that came to my mind, but there's two other names that I've seen other people mention. I'm like, okay, I can dig that. One would be Shogun Hua, saying he gets past Lil Nog coming up here. And I'll give you another guy that maybe comes up to 85 to fight him. Steven Wonderboy Thompson.
Oh, that's a great answer, because they have such intriguing styles, and That's a good one, man. Another name I thought of, and I saw that Chael actually mentioned it, of that ilk would have been Robbie Lawler. Would be another name. I think the Nick Diaz, another run that one back, or a Nate Diaz fight, that's possible. That's going to give you the big money, because I know Anderson has a big contract. And then two fights that you could make that they can't make, because these guys are under contract in different promotions. But two fights that you could make, and I think they would be really interesting because... Well, the reason why they'd be interesting is because it'd be the first time we would see these two quote-unquote big names fight each other. It would be a fight against Rampage Jackson and a fight against Tito Ortiz. It would be... We're talking about a 45-year-old Anderson Silva. This guy's so past his prime. So those types of fights is also what I would be looking at. The we were great in the mid-2000s main event.
Yeah, I mean, I think that... And, you know, Dana has mentioned that he's not sure what to do with Anderson. He's, as you said, he's poo-pooed on the Anthony Pettis idea, which that was a fight that, I don't know, I was never really like, oh, hey, let's see that one. I mean, I don't, like, look, I don't want to see him against a guy like Marvin Vettori, because what do I think Marvin Vettori is going to try to do? He's going to try to grapple him. If you tell me that you've got two more fights left with Anderson before he calls it a career, I want him in there against a guy who's going to strike.
Yeah, exactly. I was just looking at it from like a promoter glance, where it's like, I want an exciting fight next, and the last fight, I want to try and make a star. So I'm looking at one of those young guys. I don't really care how the fight looks. I just want to build him up, whoever beats him, as a potential guy in middleweight. Like a perfect example would have been a year ago, Edmund Shabazian. You know, Adesanya was a guy who was used in that role earlier. So that's why, but the first fight would be, let's do an exciting fight. Let's do a fight against a name that's going to bring in pay-per-view buys so we can make some money. And let's give him someone who's not like a top-tier fighter either.
Yeah, I guess the question is, what is the appetite for an Anderson Silva fight in the MMA community?
I think it's there just because nostalgia sells, as we've seen. I mean,
Hell, people still kind of cared about Tito and Chuck. They didn't care about it a lot, but that was, like, really bad. But Anderson is someone who matters a lot more than either of those two currently, and I think if promoted right, an Anderson fight would certainly do that. But again, this guy's only, like, won one time in a very long time, so he hasn't looked particularly good lately. And again, we are talking about a 45-year-old whose body must be aching.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can only imagine what that body feels like at this point. But, yeah, I mean, look, and I would think that, well, if we were in a normal world, Daniel, you would do both those fights in Brazil.
Yeah, that's the other sad thing, is it's probably going to be a while until we start going international with fight crowds and whatnot and creating those special atmospheres. And that's how you would want to send Anderson Silva off. You know, it's a shame that Daniel Cormier is going to be sent off not in front of a crowd. At least that's what we think of now. So I hope Anderson's last fight is at least in front of fans, and obviously the best place would be Rio de Janeiro.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing that we're all kind of wondering as sports fans, of when will we get to a time where fans are going to be allowed in the building. You know, Dana White mentioned last week that, you know, he's not, you know, if he can do a capacity of 50%, that's not something he's interested in. You know, if there's going to be a crowd, he wants it to be where, you know, people can be sitting right next to each other. And I think that there's a lot of sports fans, and, you know, I don't know how close we are to having fans inside an arena or in a stadium, but I do feel this, Daniel. If you told me, like, let's just say, you know, hockey, we know, is pretty much coming back. Okay. If you said the Tampa Bay Lightning are playing whoever in the Stanley Cup playoffs here in Tampa, Amalie Arena, you can buy a ticket to the game, but you got to sign a waiver saying that you hold the team harmless, I think a lot of people would sign that waiver.
Yeah, I think so too, especially during that time. I think we're going to go through a really bad period in this country with the virus for a month, but by the time we get to the Stanley Cup finals, I think people will sign that. And, you know, people miss being in sporting events. And so by that point in time, yeah, I think so. I mean, the WWE put in some fans in the crowd. Not that many, but a couple for their Monday Night Raw. But I think they actually canceled tapings on Tuesday because one of their talents tested positive. But Stanley Cup time, I think we'll see some fans in the stands, especially in Florida. Y'all are crazy.
Bro, I was out on last Friday night. People don't care about social distancing. I'm just telling you that. They want to belly up to the bar.
Yeah, that's what I'm telling you, man. This stuff's going to – I think this stuff's going to be bad in a couple weeks, but, you know – excuse me, sorry. I think we'll probably be we will have fans in the hockey finals. I think we will, just because, you know, things are changing. And I think it's one of those things, especially with this deal. It's two steps forward, one step back is probably what we're going to see here. But by the time that point in time, we'll probably be quite a few steps forward.
Well, and to me, I think it seems pretty clear to me that I think our president, you know, President Trump wants to have fans in attendance. I think that he's looking at sports to turn, you know, to help the economy. I think anyone that's involved in business, they understand what the current economy is. You know, it does feel to me that President Trump wants sports to have fans. I mean, I think it's more of a question of, you know, I think, what was it, New Zealand? I believe last week they allowed fans to a stadium for rugby because there was no, I believe that there's no active new cases of coronavirus in New Zealand.
Yeah, I read an article about that. That was, well, because New Zealand, like, dude, they went hard. I mean, there's like only like 5 million people in New Zealand, so it's like a lot smaller, but they went hard, bro. Like, they locked down. They like gave up like their privacy and did like social tracing, and like they went hard and they got rid of the coronavirus thus far. And, they went hard in the paint. They had zero cases. I believe they still don't have any. Could be wrong about that. Haven't looked at it since I read that article. So now they're just like, all right, guys, back to normal. No international flights, but we're back to normal. So yeah, they're back to normal because they got rid of it. It's obviously possible in that country because there's, you know, what, over 300 million people in the United States and 5 million in New Zealand. So there's a pretty big difference.
I was at the grocery store last week just picking up some lunch, and there was a person that was literally 2 feet behind me. I thought about, should I turn around and go social distancing?
I know, in a grocery store, chill out, bro. Like, come on. God. Even before social distancing, I wouldn't want people up in my grill in a grocery store. But, yeah, after coronavirus, get out of my way.
Yeah, man, I have found myself, like, it's either go to the grocery store first thing in the morning or, like, the last hour they're open.
Yeah, yeah. Like the one thing that, like, everyone wanted to do when the pandemic hit was go to the grocery store. it was like the new club in America.
Dude, and I'm telling you, every time I go and look, you can't get disinfectant spray, you can't get wipes. You know, disinfectant wipes. I mean, it's amazing to me, like, just the fact of there's just certain things you go to the store that you can't get.
Yeah, yeah. The supply was not there for the insane demand of those things, man. I'm just glad I still have toilet paper is all I got to say about that.
Yeah, I 2 weeks into it, I went to Sam's Club and they had a big case of it. So I grabbed, you know, one of the, you know, big rolls type thing, you know, the one that has, like, you know, 12, 15 things in one. But yeah, thankfully, yeah, for us, it's at that time, I remember, like, walking to Sam's Club, they were only letting 50 people in at a time. So I think I literally I stood outside for like an hour just trying to get in. But it made the shopping very easy when there was only 50 people inside the building. But yeah, man, it's interesting. You know, here in Florida, you know, our governor's trying to open things up. Yeah, I mean, looking, it wouldn't shock me if the first UFC event with fans in attendance is in the state of Florida.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that's been, you know, your governor's MO, and obviously the UFC's already run events there, and I think in all likelihood that's going to be the case. Is the first UFC with fans will probably be in Florida. Abu Dhabi.
I think if inside the United States, if I was going to pinpoint states that I thought would probably be the one that would make sense, I would look at Florida, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico.
Yeah, I would also put Texas in that list.
Yeah, you are wild. You're just like us. You're wild people.
Yeah, Texas and Florida are very similar states. But I think Florida's the odds-on favorite, especially given that they were the place who gave the UFC a home to run their first shows amidst the lockdown.
Like, think about this. Like, if you look at the UFC Apex, for example, and because obviously, you know, the casinos are now back opened up in Vegas. What if the UFC said, you know what, we're going to do a show at the UFC Apex, and we are going to sell 200 tickets? They could probably put a pretty big price point on those tickets.
They could, but it'd be a major. I wouldn't do it because to me, the UFC Apex is like their golden goose. Like, they can keep that place clean and limited and whatnot. And you really want to bring in 200 people? You know, what if like five of them are sick afterwards? Then you're screwed. And then you got to close that place down. But
The thing that I was laughing about watching, and it's been on a couple events, whether it's Bruce Buff or Joe Martinez, do we really got to yell into the microphone when there's no fans?
Yeah, I know. It's quite funny. That and, yeah, stuff like that where it's just normal, but it would look so weird to have the announcer do the announcing without a microphone. it would look absurd, so you got to do it.
Yeah, but it's, you know, look, these UFC events have been enjoyable. I'm looking forward to watching Saturday's UFC fight card. Of course, be sure to go over to the MMA Report's YouTube channel. Be sure to subscribe to the channel on YouTube. You can check out some of the latest interviews that I've got posted up there. Frank Camacho, Ian Heinisch, Alex Perez, Kama Worthy, Christian Aguilera, Maurice Green. Also, got a couple other interviews lined up this week as well. Talk to Sean Woodson. This week, he's got a fight coming up next week, a catchweight bout at 150 pounds against Kyle Nelson. Spoke to him about that. So be sure to subscribe to that, to our YouTube channel. Also, be sure you're subscribing to the show, which is now available on Spotify. Of course, if there's ever a topic or discussion you want Dale and I to have on this podcast, a really simple way is you can either tweet at me at Jason_Floyd. You can shoot me an email, Jason@radioinfluence.com. And Daniel and I will definitely talk about that here on the podcast. So let's go wrap it up for this week's edition of the MMA Report podcast, which comes out every Wednesday on RadioInfluence.com.
This is an In the Trenches with Ian Beckles quick fix on Radio Influence.
Now, the NFL hopefully is going to start on time. I wouldn't bet anything on that. And I said months ago, and I've changed my stance, and I'm coming back to where I started. I'm not sure there's going to be sports this year. I really don't. The baseball, they can't come to an agreement. Those, you know, billionaires can't come off a little bit of money. God forbid they don't make billions of dollars. That'd be awful. Basketball, there's people wondering if it's really all that important. And just today, Zeke Elliott came down with COVID. All right? So we have one of the most popular NFL football players on the most popular team coming down with COVID. Now, there's a couple other Cowboy players that did. There's some pictures of Zeke Elliott at the facility, not working out, but just talking to people. Well, all of them have to go get tested. So do you see the domino effect? How is this going to work? So if Zeke Elliott was, if say it was training camp, then you find out that Zeke Elliott has a COVID. Who has to go get tested? Who's on quarantine for 14 days? Can you answer the question? Everybody in the offense, the whole 11 people in the huddle, everybody in his meeting room, his coach. How are you going to quarantine people on a football field, on a football team for 14 days? I'm supposed to be away from people for 14 days. How's that going to happen? So because I was exposed to one guy with it, with no symptoms, and I tested negative, I have to be quarantined for 14 days. It takes one player for that whole football team to shut down. One. And it's shut down for 2 weeks. Then you could try it again. And if somebody else comes down with you, you all shut it down again for 2 weeks. It's not going to work. I'm telling you, it's not going to work.
In the Trenches with Ian Beckles can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Podcasts, and RadioInfluence.com.